I've found that a lot of people don't want to come in. And if they do, the actual delivery of legal services almost is completely virtual now. Email, document sending, because they come in, I call it the touch. They're like, oh, look, you're a real lawyer. Wonderful.
Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 169 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyro, once again, your host. Today, my guests are Sophia Lingos and Pete Roberts. And I'm very excited to have them on the show today to talk about a topic that comes up all the time when we talk to solo and small firm practitioners. And it's the answer to the question, what do I do if I have a long-term illness? Or what do I do if I'm incapacitated? Or how do I provide a legacy for my firm so that when I exit the practice of law, what I've built can continue and last for some time, and maybe even provide for my family? So we're going to talk today about two very important topics, or kind of one general topic. Your business continuity plan, how to maintain your business in a continuous fashion if disaster should happen. What are the elements of an effective succession plan? How do you go about creating that? And how to plan for the interaction between continuity and succession. So I think it's a fascinating discussion. I got to be honest, I learned a ton from listening to these two. And I hope you do the same. So without any further delay, here are Sophia Lingos and Pete Roberts. Sophia Lingos, Pete Roberts, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you very much, Neil.
Well, I'm delighted that the two of you could be here today. As we talked about before, the both of you came highly recommended to me on this subject area of succession planning and what attorneys can do to prepare for the future in terms of the succession of their law firm. But before we get into that topic area, let's talk about each of you, Sophia and Pete. Tell us a little bit about yourselves and how you came to be where you are today. Sophia, we'll start with you. Tell us what goes on and what brings you to Boston.
Yeah, so I am the managing attorney of Trident Legal. We represent small businesses and startups in diverse transactional matters. I'm also the principal of Confidential Counselor Consulting. And to that end, we provide confidential consulting services to lawyers, law firms, startups, and small businesses on anything from growth strategies, reorganization, business challenges, and just general coaching. And I'm also a law professor at Northeastern Law, where I teach law practice management and access to justice. I came here for school. I married a boy from Texas, so we've decided, even though I'm from Utah and he's from Texas, we both really like Boston, and so it seemed like the perfect place to make our home, and I've been here for 15 years.
Wow, that's quite a transition. You can take the Texas the boy out of Texas, but can you take the Texas out of the boy?
I don't know. When everyone asks when we're going to go back, he always says, when Harvard moves to Texas, then we'll move back to Texas, so I think we're safe for some time.
Pete, how about you? You're all the way out in Seattle. Tell us about yourself and how you came to be there.
Sure, Neil. I'm not a native of the Northwest. Actually, I'm an East Coaster, as you guys are. I grew up in the Jersey Shore area and then later in the D.C. area. Went to high school in Rockville, Maryland, and met my wife in New Hampshire, of all places. And I say of all places because she's Japanese, and she wanted to be closer to Japan, and I decided, well, let's go to Seattle and see if I can make my way there, and was successful doing that 26 years ago. I have an MBA from the College of William & Mary, and I've worked in law firms for 18 years, and then went with the Washington State Bar Association for 13 years to manage their Law Office Management Assistance Program, which was a program recommended by the American Bar Association to help bar associations on the local level help their members to avoid issues that could lead to grievances. Over the last 6 years, I'm now an independent practice management consultant, the principal of my own firm, and assist attorneys here, principally in the Northwest. I have a few national clients, but typically here in the Northwest, and enjoy what I do very, very much.
Well, you know that Rockville, Maryland is near and dear to my heart, right?
I wasn't sure if you grew up there, Neil.
I've been here long enough to say that, you know, I'm kind of a Rockville native, but I married a gal whose family goes back three generations in Rockville. So So we're pretty well entrenched, and that's where my office is. I'd like to say it's outside of Washington, D.C., but really Washington, D.C. is outside of Rockville.
Yeah.
So both of you work with law firms. What are the typical types of firms you work with? Are they solo, exclusively solos or small firms, or do you work with some mid-sized firms? And of course, that definition is open for interpretation, but who's your typical client?
Well, in my case, it's going to be typically a solo practitioner, although not exclusively, a small firm also I can assist. And the reasons for assisting the solo would be for startup issues. If it's a newer admittee, it would be increasing efficiency of the firm. It could be a successful firm, but they want to take the pulse and understand what's working and what might not be working so well. And then also transitional issues, winding down or contemplating a merger, or it could be a partner in a large firm seeking to go out on their own. And they want some coaching as to, you know, what are the alligators that they need to worry about if they're going to do that. So it's a wide range of subject matter, and every day is different. I just can't say I'm always doing one thing. It's quite a variety of things. And I'm also conscious that the subject matter of what I deal with is not the internal practice of law, in other words, preparing for depositions and writing briefs. Subject matter is the management of the firm and from different angles. And that's not a sexy subject for most attorneys because they'd rather just practice law. So I find myself attempting to make this subject matter as accessible as possible. And I'm fortunate to be able to be the finance column author for the Law Practice magazine of the ABA. And in those articles, I always try to inject some humor and some human interest to keep the reader from glazing over too much if I have too many tables of numbers or too many acronyms.
Well, you're a perfect fit for this podcast because, you know, I'm not smart enough to talk about true legal issues all day. And frankly, our audience really wants to hear about the business of running a law firm. So it's a perfect fit. Sophia, how about you? Some of the clients that you work with as a practicing attorney, you know, on one side of your life and as a business coach and legal advisor on the other, what are some of the clients, the nature of the clients that you work with?
So it's really anywhere from a small to a medium-sized firm, and it's sometimes solo practitioners. From a medium-sized firm, which are actually pretty large out here in Boston, I usually am doing more trying to implement paperless practices, trying to understand what's the best technology, making sure from an efficiency standpoint, doing an overall legal audit that assists them when they have to bring in someone from the outside to ensure that everything is running as smoothly as possible. But I think this small firm is really my sweet spot, both from a consulting standpoint and from a legal representation standpoint. The consulting is really secondary to my true legal representation.
Sure.
That comes in from formation, even sometimes from a financing, but it's really formation, understanding employment, understanding growth, making sure that attorneys, even though a lot of times we think as an attorney, well, why would I be hiring another lawyer to do this job? Well, I have a very niche practice and spend a lot of time specifically representing attorneys in, and I never say corporate matters because I think corporate gets bigger than what it is that we do. I say transactional business matters. Mm-hmm. And so those are pretty vast and I'm able to provide the full gamut of services within that world.
And Sophia, how do you typically deliver those services? Is it via face-to-face meetings? Or are you doing, you know, Zoom
meetings? More often,
meetings?
It's very virtual. It blows my mind. I was trying to do the math the other day to figure out. I said, even more than 50% of my clients now, I haven't met in person unless I've met them in some other capacity professionally. My business is very referral-based, and I do a lot of speaking just in a practice management setting. So I've formed relationships with lawyers that way. But it's interesting how many people never come to the office. We're in downtown Boston, we have parking, but we also do a lot of, so Zoom is a great way to give people the option if they want to see your face. Some of my international clients solely want to do video conferencing. They don't want to just pick up the phone. It's not just, I don't think, the ability to connect with you without, you know, long distance fees, whatever they are these days. But yeah. I've found that a lot of people don't want to come in. And if they do, the actual delivery of legal services almost is completely virtual now. Email, document sending, because they come in, I call it the touch. They're like, oh, look, you're a real lawyer. Wonderful. There is something different about LegalZoom and having an opportunity to have that conversation and begin forming the relationship to show what is the difference between just having a document prepared on your behalf versus having somebody really assist you in determining what's right for your practice. And we try and do that as well, but it's also up to the client. How do people want to communicate? What works best for them? And I try to meet them where they are.
And Pete, how about you? What's the typical way that you provide the services you offer?
Yes, I also enjoy a referral base and don't do a whole lot of marketing, but I'm busy enough. And I'll have an initial conversation with the attorney to see if I can be of help. I want to hear about what their concerns are, and I don't charge for that. I typically end up being retained, though, but I just want the attorney to feel as though they're free to politely say, Pete, no, I think I need to find somebody else, kind of thing.
Sure.
Then, if retained, I'll send them an audit form to look at their firm on a number of different angles. It's about 17 pages long, where they tell me answers to a number of questions that helps me frame how I'm going to approach the meeting I'd like to have. And I don't do so much virtual consulting. I do prefer to do in person if possible, because I want to see the lawyer's environment. I just want to see how they're set up. And meeting in their space, I would suggest, might be a little bit more comfortable than meeting at Starbucks or in my office space. So I always attempt to have a meeting. That meeting lasts maybe 2 to 3 hours, and I'll follow up with information I may need to research, documents, materials, et cetera. I have a significant archive of historical materials about practice management and provide them a report. I also like to follow up over time to kind of hold their feet to the fire and keep them on track if they've made some commitments to some changes in their practice area. You know, that said, I'm a big believer in small steps leading to big results. I'm not about turning everybody on their head, you know, changing their website from top to bottom or necessarily going into a different practice area. Although, practice area is a subject near and dear to my heart because it drives everything else the lawyer does in terms of types of clients, types of documents, scheduling, how thick the file gets, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, it's an interesting dichotomy or approaches between the two of you. So it really spans the gamut. You know, one of the things that we get an opportunity to hear from the guests that come on the show, particularly the solo practitioners, is the kinds of challenges that they have when starting up a practice and and operating and trying to build a practice. And there's a few areas that over the course of time we come to discover aren't as part of the planning process as maybe one would like. And a couple of those come to mind as of late and things that I wanted to ask you about and the two of you about. So one of those is, you know, if I'm a solo practitioner and I'm wearing all the hats in the firm, I'm doing the legal work, I'm doing the marketing work, I'm doing the administrative work, I'm doing the financial work, I haven't yet gotten the growth that's necessary to start and outsource those or hire to provide for those activities. I truly am, you know, the only person working in the office. What happens if I get sick? How do I handle that? And what happens? And I'm talking about more than just a cold. What if I have something that really takes me down for a couple of weeks or more? And just kind of that overall planning for coverage when we don't have any resources. So, Sophia, what are your thoughts in that area?
Yeah, that's a great question, something we often address. In Massachusetts, from a malpractice standpoint, you are required to list a backup individual. And when I talk to people about, oh, well, who have you listed? Or I've had many people come and ask me to be that person. I said, well, what do you intend? Do you understand really the responsibility that you're asking of these people? What have you done to prepare? And I don't think people take it as seriously as they absolutely need to. When I work with entrepreneurs, the first conversation we have is, what's your exit strategy? And an exit strategy does not just mean at the end of the day, when all of a sudden something happens, like we're going to sell out, it also happens in the terms of death and disability. So one thing that we can do is actually identify that individual. And what I have set up on my computer, we use practice management software, everything lives there. So if you are having an organized and online practice, that way, somebody, if they were to need to take over your practice, would be able to access that. My individual that I have as my backup person, we have an agreement between us about what exactly happens. And I have, if I had to make any changes or updates, also within my estate plan is the code. If someone were to need to sign into my practice management software, is enough. They'd be able to log on. You'd be able to see these are the active matters right now, and understand what tasks are open and be able to contact each and every one of my clients and possibly determine if those individuals that are not listed as active clients need to be contacted as well. And again, I have very clear instructions about what that is. I also had meeting, and this attorney will be compensated for their time in performing all these services. Otherwise, it's a really big ask. You can't just list somebody as your backup. It's not just a formality to let your malpractice provider know, hey, yeah, I'm covered. You need to have a relationship with someone, and you need to ensure that they're also within your industry. I had somebody from a practice area that I know absolutely nothing about. And though I feel confident in using the same software that would be able to log on, I wouldn't necessarily be able to help them analyze anything that was active. I'm not a litigator. So if I looked at their court schedule, I wouldn't even know the right people to call. So even if it's not specifically in your small niche, I think the importance of having a litigator or a transactional attorney who can navigate what it is that needs to be accomplished in order to fulfill that time period. My spouse has an activation plan, so he knows if something were to happen. I'd like to hope that I'd be okay for a week, because again, I'm not a litigator, so it wouldn't be something that's happening from a court standpoint. But a lot of times, there are matters that are taking place that have a pretty quick timeline and turnaround. It could be the difference from a client getting some serious funding versus not. It could be something from the SEC that we're on a short timeline, something with the IRS. So we definitely have time-sensitive tasks that are taking place. And so my spouse is supposed to know. And guess what? Sometimes, just like with any estate plan, my legal estate plan aligns with my practice estate plan, my personal estate plan. So if the two of us went down in a plane, there's a next step in line, and that information is all contained within. And sometimes when I talk about this, people say, oh my God, that's a lot. It seems like a lot, just like when you're going through an estate plan, just like when you're thinking, who's going to watch my children in that horrible accident? But these are things you have to think through. I work a lot with having those hard conversations with people of what happens. So figuring what happens, who's going to hold the keys, and who you can get on board and incentivize them to be able to take over in the event that you're unavailable.
Today, I'd like to introduce a new sponsor to The Law Entrepreneur, and that's the folks at Jurisdiction. You started your law practice to ditch the firm life and be your own boss, but your practice is running you. The good news, being an attorney entrepreneur doesn't have to be this hard. Jesse and Megan, the lawpreneurs behind Jurisdiction, are working to build a new generation of solo practitioners who love being lawyers. This year, Jurisdiction is introducing a new program, Next Level Law Practice. Next Level Law Practice is a rigorous training program that provides the tools and business fundamentals for estate planning attorneys to start and grow a profitable and streamlined legal business. Next Level Law Practice gives you access to videos, worksheets, templates, one-on-one coaching, and live group sessions that allow you to ask questions and learn on your own schedule. To learn more about the program, visit thrivejd.com. That's thrivejd.com. They're even offering an exclusive coupon code for the Law Entrepreneur listeners. Just enter the code TLE150, that's like the Law Entrepreneur 150, for a $150 discount off your course registration. And welcome to the show, Jurisdiction. Support for today's episode comes from Ruby Receptionists, dedicated to helping you grow your practice one happy caller at a time. From their offices in Portland, Oregon, Ruby's live remote receptionists create an exceptional experience for your callers by answering calls live with your custom greeting, delighting callers in English or Spanish, transferring calls, taking messages, collecting new client intake, and much more. Just like an in-house receptionist at a fraction of the cost. For 15 years, Ruby has been turning rings into relationships. For more information, call 844-895-7829 or visit callruby.com/lawentrepreneur. Well, let's walk that back just a little bit, because there's a lot to digest there, and I want to make sure that I got it all, because really this is all about me. So in Massachusetts, you are required to identify a succession attorney.
As a sole practitioner through your malpractice insurance, which is not legally required, you could operate. It's a bad idea, but it is an option. So your malpractice insurance requires you to identify a successor in the event for all sole practitioners.
Interesting. Okay. I'm not sure that that's true in every jurisdiction, is it?
That I'm not sure of.
Yeah. Yeah, so it would be worth our while for those listening to the program to check to see, because you want to make sure you're compliant with that and not just ignoring it through ignorance. I have to admit, it's the first I've ever heard of malpractice or state bar requiring that specification.
At least malpractice is pretty good about letting you know what the requirements are.
Yeah.
So I will say they wouldn't let you in Massachusetts hand in your paperwork without having that name. There would be a follow-up at least from our state.
Yeah, for sure. That makes sense. And so it takes on a lot of different aspects. When you are, like you said, like choosing a guardian for your children, If you're talking about a successor, you want to make sure that that's somebody that you have some type of relationship with, and obviously, preferably it would be somebody who you have a significant relationship with, a friendship or business associate. And then I guess it also would make sense to guarantee that the person uses the same practice management tool and is able to use the resources that you have in your firm if you want to seamlessly transition, if it's a kind of an emergency.
I think it's very helpful to have someone who understands the practice management tools. I think that someone could probably figure it out or turn to the support that is available usually within practice management softwares. I think if you aren't on a platform, it's a lot more challenging to just say, okay, come to my office. Here's my filing system. Figure out what's open, what's closed. But again, if that's the route that you're going, just having clear instructions about how, where, and updating that information as often as it must be updated. So a person were able to follow your instructions in the event of a catastrophe.
Yeah. Now, do you put that into a document, into a procedure, or how are you reporting, you know, what they would have to do in order to take over your practice on the fly?
Yep. So I have that in a document that is accessible by either my spouse or the next in line. But then I have a contract with the individual that would take it on. So the contract, you know, stays as is. But in the event that I've added some new technology or I've made some change to our filing system or anything, I'm able to update the document. So if that's what they would get in form of activation if we were to have to proceed.
Interesting. Peter, what are your thoughts on doing that front-end planning in terms of identifying a successor?
Well, first of all, it was a breath of fresh air to hear Sophia discuss her planning. It's quite impressive and unfortunately a fairly rare occurrence in my experience with most attorneys, but kudos to you, Sophia.
Thank you.
When I was with the Washington State Bar Association, I came into contact with the custodianship program at the bar, which is a program where when a lawyer is disabled, the Bar Association is empowered to appoint a volunteer attorney to go into that lawyer's office and parse out the files to the clients and or to other attorneys. Very cumbersome and slow process. And looming within that process is access to the trust account. That becomes a major hurdle because in Washington State, at least, only an attorney can sign checks for that account. And if there's no one else in that office who can access the trust account, then we have to wait for some kind of a court order to allow access, which takes time. Meanwhile, the client has immediate needs and client interests can be certainly affected and harmed by that delay. So I say that by way of preamble because when I meet with attorneys, often who don't even have staff to help another attorney access the priorities of the practice if that lawyer is disabled or ill or passes away. So it's very, very important that a formal agreement be in place to both identify the backup attorney and give some guidance to how that attorney will assist the practice if the need arises. So it's a critical issue that Sophia and I talked about at the tech show earlier this year. The solo practitioner setting is a very, very risky one if that solo practitioner is disabled or otherwise unable to practice. So we do recommend looking at the details of the practice and certainly a consistent practice area experienced attorney to help figure out what the priorities are.
Yeah, I can see how that kind of gets into very much the analogy of the law firm estate plan, you know, same as your own personal estate plan. Now, Sophia, along those lines, why would you have some of that information in your personal estate plan, i.e. kind of the log-on information and that? What's the rationale for separating that?
Yeah, so it's just hosted there in the event. So somebody who was looking, who would probably be the first thing if, like I said, if something were to happen catastrophic to myself and spouse, the first place other people would think to look would not necessarily say, oh my God, what are we going to do with her law firm? It would be, okay, what do we do with the children? So to me, it's important to have that living. It lives in two spaces, but to have that living in a space where people would be able to say, oh, okay, well, here is this information. We need to get on this immediately. And to have people in my immediate personal circle to know to notify if an event were to take place.
You know, I use a password manager, for instance, to manage all of my passwords. And so what I've included in some of my planning documents is just the where to find the master key, so to speak. And then that gives them the access to specific sets of logins that I want them to have in order to be able to operate my business. And it's really critical for me. Now, I haven't identified anybody yet. I've got the plan in place, but it's really critical to me that it would be somebody that would be able to use some of those tools, because if you're not able to use those tools, it's going to take you a long, if you're as devoted to going paperless as I am, and as I know you are, Sophia, it makes it a lot more difficult to get up and running if you don't already have some level of expertise.
Absolutely. And I think having the master key is a great way to prepare to give somebody that information. I have that included in mine as well. And I actually had realized that I had to update. I finally had to update my master key and get everything reset. And so making sure that that little change is able to be changed in your document. So having a document that could be updated, whoever is going to be having access to it.
Now, Peter, does it make sense to do this planning in the formation stage? Or is that too early? Better yet, when's a good time to start this kind of planning?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think my answer would be to wait. I think in the formation stage of the practice, there are too many unknowns. I think things have to settle down, so to speak, to allow the attorney to, frankly, identify, well, what is the practice management software we're going to use? Or what are the practice areas, both initially and maybe later on, that might change and suggest a different backup attorney at some point. So I believe there should be established systems in place, some kind of a track record, so to speak, of the practice before the planning process becomes put into writing. Certainly, giving thought to it along the way is okay. Obviously, thinking about what are the contingencies that could occur. Nothing wrong with thinking about those things, of course. But I think there should be a delay before you actually finally identify the backup attorney and put a plan into print so that there's mutual understanding of how things will occur.
Do you?
I might disagree a little bit there, okay. Just because I would say when I sit down with entrepreneurs in general, they get really excited to start talking about, we're just starting. What are we going to do next? And the first conversation I have with them is, what's your exit strategy? And the exit strategy is not just in the event of, you know, death, disability. With regards to death and disability, you don't know what could happen tomorrow. So I think it is necessary as soon as you're taking on your first client and during that planning stage where you have much more time, all documents can be updated and amended, but it's so critical to put things in writing on paper and try and transfer your practice and focus on the practice of law. But you never know when something's going to happen, right? That's why it is the unknown. So it would be great to be thinking about it, but you also want to be prepared when that event happens. I've changed my person 3 times who's my backup attorney. I used to have a partner that worked with me. I had somebody else who has moved their practice area. And I have a third person who I actually recently brought on as I was, you know, renewing, and I sat down and had a more detailed conversation and set up the compensation structure for them. So it's progressed from where it was initially to, you know, short understanding and here's how you would access my information. So I think it can absolutely evolve and I completely agree there, but having something from the very beginning, I think is incredibly important.
Does it make a difference if you have more... To what degree does it make a difference? If you have multiple practice areas, I mean, might you consider having a different backup or successor attorney for different practice areas if they're significantly, you know, different?
I think it depends on what the role of that individual is going to be. In a perfect world, if you were thinking through an exit strategy of a firm, you're thinking of how you can build a practice that has value even if you're not working it. So let's think about just from a beginning formation stage, we converted our firm. It used to be Lingos Law. No one wants to buy my firm, Lingos Law, when Sophia Lingos is no longer the managing attorney. And there's definitely value in some firms' names. Down the road, there are plenty of firms where, you know, they're still operating under that name, but things are changing. So from the transition to Trident Legal, where I'm trying to do brand value and it's trademarked and that that would actually be an asset in itself that is built into my plan. So it's not just about someone jumping in and taking over all my clients at Trident Legal. I believe that there's an inherent value in my firm. So someone is coming in to triage. They're coming in to make sure that there is clients are being taken care of. Anything that's on the docket is getting done and again, being compensated in order to do so. But I think you can also then have what is the value that is your practice and how can that, just like any of your other assets would be taken care of, how that can that be taken care of to either sell your practice or bring somebody in who would inherit your clients and figuring out how that proceeds.
And I can see where that intersection, particularly on the exit strategy, if God forbid you've passed away, how that would intersect with your own personal estate plan if you have beneficiaries that you want to benefit from the sale of that of your practice. So the successor attorney would be charged with the responsibility of maintaining the operation of the firm and then overseeing or cooperating with those who are managing the sale of that practice so that your ultimate estate beneficiaries can reap the rewards of that work.
Exactly.
Yeah, I agree with that. I spoke with a bank manager recently about that, and there certainly is a big difference in their mind about whether the attorney is disabled and who they'll listen to about access to the accounts versus an attorney who has passed away. And of course, the will document and the personal representative would take over at that point in time. So I've always recommended that the attorney talk to their financial institution or institutions about these issues so that there's clarity.
Yeah, the time to resolve those problems is while everybody's coherent and present.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it also very much speaks to the issue in terms of exit strategy about how you position your firm ultimately if you decide to leave. And as you were saying, Sophia, you know, if your practice carries your name on the front door, then it's a different discussion in terms of selling those resources or making that merging with a another firm down the road or whatever your exit strategy might be. So that's an area where one has to be considering the future along with the whole succession role.
That's right. And I think a lot of people think of the old days where you could really sell a practice. You could sell a book of business. Nowadays, with Google, if you are going to leave, you have to give your clients an option. They could seek new counsel. It doesn't mean that we could sell a book of business. Somebody comes in, automatically inherits all of my clients. And more often than not, when I'm working with firms who are going through a transition process, whether it's reorganization or somebody's retiring and working to sell their practice, a lot of the clients are going to go, instead of just listening to who their attorney says should be the next counsel, they're going to move on to whoever their family lawyer or who their best friend, their neighbor recommends, or who they find on Google doing their own independent research. And so we're seeing a lot more of that. So the value from an exit standpoint is not vested like it was previously in your book of business. Along those lines, people used to sell their law library. It's not like you're inheriting and walking into an office any longer with all these valuable books. That doesn't exist. Everything is in the computer. Most practices should be in the computer. You don't want to inherit all those files, actually. You want the clients, but you don't want the backlog of thousands of files that people haven't gotten through or had best practices of disposing of whenever the time has come. So a lot of things that people thought were of value are no longer. And so thinking from a formation standpoint, how we can create a practice that is going to be the best situated for a sellable exit. You don't want to just end your practice. And that is one exit. One exit is, all right, I saw my last client, I'm walking out the door. But if you're building a business, this is not how other businesses operate. Other business providers don't think, and I'm saying providers, service providers, not just businesses who have a backlog of, water bottles. Business providers who exit are not thinking, I'm just going to close their doors. They're trying to build something of value. And I really encourage attorneys to think that way as well. So when I leave, How am I leaving something behind? Now, another way is to bring in someone. Even if you've been operating as a sole practitioner, bringing in an attorney who you work with them for them to buy out your practice. And I've seen that to be a very successful exit and transition.
Yeah, I can see how that would be one approach and maybe one that people use more than, say, a third-party successor attorney often cases. So that kind of resonates with me in the thinking.
Your discussion brings to mind the subject of original wills. If the attorney does have those are the responsibility of that attorney and their successors. In Washington State, you are able to file an original will with the clerk of the court for a small fee so that you're unburdened from having to deal with original wills later on.
Yeah, I've seen that in my own practice here, where every once in a while on the listserv, you'll see an attorney say, hey, has anybody prepared a will for this person? Obviously, the person has passed and they don't have the original will. And that's part of the reason why I, as an estate planning attorney, I don't keep the original wills. That's way too much responsibility. I suggest they do exactly what you mentioned, Pete, and that is, you know, register them with the county authority or else, you know, have stored them on their own in some type of protective situation. So last question here I want to get to is, who makes sure the bills are paid? Is it going to be the same person, or is that another function that can be outsourced at some point to another party, or am I over-engineering the problem?
Are you talking about bills from vendors or the attorney's bills to clients?
The latter.
So I've been pretty lucky where I have 100% collection rate. And I have the system pretty set up. Part of what is built into my plan is that upon notification that a final bill would be sent to the clients with anticipation that they would be able to make payment. We utilize LawPay that goes directly through my practice management, and that's how more than 94% of my clients make their payment. So I think from using technology in a very streamlined process, it would be pretty easy for people to quit. You would hit send bill, send bill, send bill, and right, everybody would receive it. So hopefully with a combination of the plan and the technology, it wouldn't be a big challenge on this end.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, so far our listeners who are saying, okay, wow, this is a daunting task. I hadn't thought about it. Clearly, I now see the need for a succession plan, or you know, and or disaster plan. You know, what happens if I'm incapacitated for, you know, more than some period of time and need somebody to take over my practice while I recuperate? I can see a lot of the attorneys out in the audience saying, "I don't know where to start." So, are there some resources that are available that you would recommend that somebody might take advantage of to get, you know, started down this road?
Across the country, there are practice management advisors with the state and even local bar associations who would likely have those resources.
Okay.
But I know in Oregon they do, and in Washington, of course, but there are about 30 of these programs nationwide. So I would invite the listener to check into their state bar or even a major city bar. Now, that said, the state of Oregon, for instance, would be happy to send their booklet about this information, as would Washington, on request to anyone. So the information is available, and I would highly recommend that your listeners pursue that tack.
Sophia, do you have a recommendation?
Yeah, there's a lot of resources that are out there. I would actually start with, if you even just Google to get a sample of having a succession plan, because malpractice providers also require, some of them might be willing to give you a sample. To me, looking, and mind you, I'm a contract attorney, so I even encourage clients sometimes to just look at a sample to get an understanding of the content that would go into one, or look at five agreements. If you can at least start using that, of putting something in writing, thinking through the steps more concretely by looking at that, I think it'll be very helpful. I think step two is after you've thought through what am I asking? You don't want to find someone right away and say, hey, would you be my person? You need to be able to tell them what you're going to be asking them to do. And so after you've identified a plan, then you want to identify the individual and have that conversation. And again, tell them that you intend this to be a compensated role. You're not just saying, hey, could you take over my practice? Think through what the additional benefits. Maybe this is the person that you'd actually want to be taking over your practice. And for fulfilling that role, you'd have it as a discounted rate for whatever the purchase price would be or however you're going to value your business at the end of the day. So there's different ways that you can incentivize people. How about say, I'll be your person, you be my person. And that's actually the relationship that I am at this stage, where I approached someone who I thought would be the perfect person and said, and you probably need the perfect person as well. Let's do this for one another. And that individual actually has multiple people at the firm, but it makes sense to have somebody outside as they're the managing partner. And so I think step one, getting a plan onto paper. Step two, finding your person. And then step three is, besides having the plan, make sure that you have a system where you can activate your plan. It's not good enough to just say, here's what you would do. And then the person, something happens and they go for activation and there's no way to actually operationally do what you have asked of them. So make sure that they're able to do what it is you're asking of them.
And I'm sensing this is not a, you do it once and you put it in the drawer kind of thing. I think it's something that behooves periodic and consistent communication with that individual.
Yeah. Absolutely.
All right. Well, listen, you've certainly given me more to think about than I really wanted to think about today.
Such a sexy topic. Lots of homework.
Yeah. Geez, that sounds great. So tell our audience how they might reach out to you if they want to follow up on anything that you've discussed today.
Okay. In my case, Pete Roberts, my email is pete@practicelawadvisoror.com or 425-418-9771 by telephone.
Great.
And Sophia? The best way to reach me is also by email. It's Sophia, S-O-F-I-A dot Lingos, L-I-N-G-O-S at trident.legal. I'm also on Twitter at Sophia Lingos ESQ, or you can check out my website, which is just trident.legal. And I'm happy to answer any follow-up questions anyone has.
That's awesome. We will include all of that in our show notes for those of you who are on the treadmill or in the car and can't write all that down. And I want to thank both of you for taking the time to really educate me and hopefully our audience and be a part of the experience here on The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, Neil, thank you so much.
Well, that will do it for today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I'd like to thank our sponsors for making this show possible, the good folks at Call Ruby Receptionists, and our newest sponsor, Jurisdiction, the providers of the Next Level Law Practice Program. So take a moment to visit our show notes and hop on over to their websites for special discounts and savings and other free stuff that you can get, and just support them because they make this podcast possible day in and day out. Also, if you got a couple minutes, pop on over to our own website, thelawentrepreneur.com. We have a couple little articles there. You can also listen to the podcast itself there if you choose to. And sign up for our newsletter or our mailing list. And we don't do a lot. You know, you're not going to bombard you with emails every week. And I do plan on doing a few more this year, but we'd love to have you join our community. And in that sense, you can also go on to our Facebook page. You can find us just by searching on The Law Entrepreneur. You can find out what we got going on a daily basis, sometimes hourly, on the Facebook page. So I'd love to have you join us there. And if you have the time, last but not least, go on over to iTunes, search on The Law Entrepreneur. And if it's something that you believe in and feel strongly about, we'd love for you to leave an honest 5-star review, as well as comments about what you like and dislike about the show, because it does mean a lot to us that you are our community, our listeners, and I want to thank you for making this all possible. So we'll see you next time on The Law Entrepreneur.